true that there is a scarlet, blood-colored thread of connection from the beginning of the Old Testament all the way through to Calvary. And all of the Old Testament leans on and points to that moment at Calvary when Jesus gave up His life on the cross. Everything in the Old Testament points to that anticipated event of Jesus coming as a baby and living a sinless life and giving up His life on the cross for the sins of the world, only to be resurrected on that glorious Easter morning day some 2,000 years ago. Over the last few weeks, we have been following that thread in a few places through the Old Testament as we talked about how Abraham was called by God to go from the place that he was to the place that God would show him. And because he got up and went and did what God wanted him to do, Abraham became the great-great-great-great-grandfather of Joseph, the earthly father of Jesus. We shared last week through that woven thread of anticipating the coming of Jesus how Daniel interpreted the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. And as a result of that interesting and fascinating tale, Daniel was able to give a prophecy of the coming kingdom that would never be defeated, the coming kingdom that had no end. It is a kingdom of the heart that comes through that moment in Calvary, that comes through that realization that what happened at Jesus on the cross has to happen in my heart and in my life as Jesus' blood, His scarlet, His red blood was shed for my sins and for yours. Today, we are going to look at a testimony, a prophecy of David. David in the Old Testament was the boy who killed Goliath, and he came on the scene and was famous at that point. He later became the great musician of the Old Testament, writing all of the Psalms, which are the songs of worship in the Old Testament church. Even today, some of our modern songs are written based upon those Psalms of old. And as a boy, David would spend time in the shepherding business out in the field, and he was worshiping the Lord and communing with the Lord in isolation in anticipation of when he would become a great leader of Israel. In the Old Testament, in the book of Samuel, David is noted as a man after God's own heart. That's a rare description for people, but David particularly is noted as a man after God's own heart. And what that means as we study the life of David is that David could reflect the heart of God in an unusual and close and special way. And yet in the middle of David's story, David failed miserably, unlike God who never fails. But David failed miserably with Bathsheba. He got with Bathsheba, he sinned a great sin of immorality. They conceived a child together, and that child was born dying. That child was born and did not live but a week. And in that week of time, when David came before the Lord and prayed that God would spare his son, born in sin, David understood how God must have felt when God had to turn his back on his only son because of sin. And it tore David apart. And the child died. And as a result of the child's death, David understood in a greater way what God had to go through in the future when his child, his only child, his boy child, died because of sin. And David was restored in that grief to becoming a man after God's own heart. It's because of that heart that David can communicate prophetically of the coming of Jesus that's at this point in the reading of Psalm 22 is still 1,000 years away. Meditate on that for a moment and think of the 1,000 years before the coming of Jesus. David, a man after God's own heart, is expressing this Son of God who will come and be the Savior of the world. You know, when we think of our days and our hours and our weeks and our calendars of time, we live and we are limited by time and space, aren't we? It's today, it's tomorrow, we have things to do next week, and that's just the world that we live in. We live hour to hour and day to day. But in the supernatural of God, God doesn't see time and space in the same way. He's not limited in that way. And so when David quotes a prophecy 1,000 years anticipating the coming of it to be fulfilled in Jesus, in David's perspective, it's 1,000 years away, and in some cases, not even sure what he's even saying as he prophesying. But from God's economy, He sees it all at once. He sees the prophecy of David and the coming of Jesus in one master scene. And so it's not a surprise that God can give that prophecy to David. When Jesus was on the cross, 1,000 years after Psalm 22, He spoke and He said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Many heard it that day and didn't fully understand what Jesus was doing and thought in their minds and in their hearts that He's just crying out in agony in His pain on the cross, and He was. To take the piercings in His wrist, to take the piercings in His feet, to take the beating within an inch of His life before that even occurred, to take the crown of thorns upon His head, to take the rejection and ridicule of mankind, and as bad as all of that was, to take upon Himself the sin of the world in that moment was a horrific moment of His life. My God, why hast Thou forsaken me? But not only was Jesus expressing His heartfelt moment there, He was also quoting Psalm 22, the Psalm of David, the man after God's own heart, and bringing 1,000 years of history all the way forward to that place on the cross. Some question and wonder about David when he wrote this psalm. Was he feeling his own anguish and his own pain and just emoting his own feelings towards God? Or was he prophesying about what was to come? There's great debate about what was happening. Was he just expressing his own heart and it became prophecy of God? Or was he in some sort of spiritual out-of-body experience just emoting something that really had no connection to him and expressing something that would happen in the future? The best that we can discover is both things were happening. That not only was David feeling this isolation, this separation from God, because when you look into the history of the moment, you'll see that David was in a very depleted place in his life. He was on the run from Saul. Saul was the king. Saul had disqualified himself from being king, and he didn't want to lose that power. And he knew that David was going to be the king in the future, and so instead of just stepping down and passing on the leadership, Saul decided to go after David and destroy him. And David was in grief because he was in this place of isolation and separation, and he expressed his own grief. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? I'll ask you a question, and I'll ask myself this question as well. Have you ever been in a moment like that when you have felt like God has forsaken you? When you felt like that when you pray, it just goes up to the ceiling and bounces back splat on the floor? When you try to reach out to God for answers, it doesn't seem like any answer has come. The weight of the world is pulling down upon my life. The weight of the world is pressing down on my shoulders. There is no thriving in me. There is no victory in me. There is no answer for me. And everything around me is in despair. Have you ever felt that way? Of course you have. Of course you have. We all have. There are those moments of despair when we cry out to God and He seems to not be interested in answering us. I think one of the reasons why God allows those times to happen is that when He does rush to our aid eventually from those places of despair, when He does rush back in and come to our rescue and answer the prayer and minister to our heart and bless us at the point of need and begin to answer the unanswerables that are in the moment of our life, it is at that point we recognize a greater dependence on God and say to Him, oh God, don't ever leave me again. Don't ever do that to me again. I cannot be without You. And He causes us a greater sense of need and a greater sense of dependence upon Him is the place where we need to be. David was pouring out his own grief. My God, why hast Thou forsaken me? And Jesus declared the same desperate cry at the cross. Several years ago, I got invited to go to a preach-off, if you will, on the seven last sayings of Jesus at the crucifixion. It was in an African-American church. I was the only white guy in the room. It was really a joy to be there. And I remember one of the young African-American preachers on the sayings of Christ, one of the young African-American preachers spoke about this phrase, my God, why hast Thou forsaken me? And he put it this way. He said at the moment of Jesus being on the cross and taking upon himself the sin of the world, it was in that moment that God could not look on him and could not look upon his sin. And then this young preacher said this that I thought really expressed the moment. That if God had not turned his back on Jesus in that moment, God in the very nature of the Father would have come and rescued Jesus from the cross. God had to turn his back on Jesus so that he would allow the Son to go through what he had to go through. As much as it broke his heart, as much as it broke Jesus' heart to be beaten and pierced and humiliated, as much as it broke Jesus' heart to take upon himself the sin of the world, it was even worse to be separated from God, even for a day or two, so that Jesus could do what God had asked him to do and that God would allow it to occur for the likes of you and me when we didn't deserve it, for the things that we've done that put Jesus there, that we didn't deserve that gift, that we didn't deserve that grace. And yet God turned his back on Jesus so Jesus could go through that experience at Calvary. He could shed his blood, his scarlet red blood at the foot of that cross and for the ages to come so that you and I wouldn't have to go through a similar death. So that you and I would not have to experience God ultimately and completely turning his back on us. And even though we feel sometimes that God does that in the moment, he never turns his back on us. He's always there for us. He's always attentive to us because he loves us. He loves us written in red. My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? David goes on in the psalm as he begins to emote from his heart. He begins to go from complete despair to abject hope and deliverance and despair and deliverance and despair and deliverance. And you can feel the torment in him as he is wrangling with God in his own spirit. And he is wrangling the prophetic of what is to come at the moment of the crucifixion and then ultimate resurrection of Jesus. In verse 21, we see that God had forsaken David. In verse 22, and in verse 1, in verse 22, 6 through 8, he speaks again and he says, I am a worm, no man, a reproach of men, despised by the people. All those who ridicule me, they shoot out the lip and shake their head and saying, he trusted in the Lord, let him rescue him. Sounds like the crowd around the Calvary scene of Jesus. You rescue yourself. You call yourself the Son of God. Call on the angels to deliver you. And Jesus resisted that and did not call on the angels to rescue him. And so David speaks of himself and he speaks of Jesus. Let him who deliver him, since he delights in him, meaning the Father. David speaks of himself, but he also speaks of the coming of Jesus. He was despised and mocked. David also recognizes that his prayers in the moment go unanswered. But in one of the verses, in verse 3, he comes to conclude, whether you hear me or not, whether you fill up that despair and emptiness with your presence or not. David speaks and he says, but you are holy. You are still holy, enthroned in the praises of Israel. Our fathers trusted in you. They trusted in you and you delivered them. They cried to you and you were delivered. They trusted in you and you were not ashamed. Dear friend, if you are here today and you align yourself with the, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? If you are in that moment in your heart, if you are in that moment in your life, my encouragement to you is follow the lead of David and call on what you knew in your past of God and claim it with all of your heart, even if you don't feel it, even if it doesn't come in the moment. Call on what you know of in the past and know that there is a time when God in his holiness delivered me. There there is a time in His holiness when He rescued me. And there is a time in His holiness when He was there for me. And I hope and I pray and I promise that God will be there for me again. And I want you to know, dear friend, it is our place in the moment of despair to the moment of hope and deliverance to continue to praise God, to continue to call on the God of what we know, anticipating what we will know when God comes and answers us. David and Jesus went through the same thing, and they came to the place of deliverance. David goes on in verse 14. At this point, he begins to speak more about Jesus than about himself. We don't know if he knows what he's doing or not. We just know that he is in tune with God and the heart of God and giving a prophecy of himself and a prophecy to the people of what will be to come, because he says, I am poured out like water. If you recall on the cross when Jesus was certainly dead, his hands and his feet and his brow, one of the soldiers came to break his leg so that he would go ahead and die and not stay on that cross till sundown. But before they broke his legs, they pierced his side. And at the piercing of his side, blood and water ran out, which was evidence that Jesus had already died. And his body did not have to be broken in order to speed up his death. I am poured out like water. All of my bones are out of joint, but not broken. David speaks of the coming of Jesus. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, like a broken piece of pottery, and my tongue clings to my jaws. Jesus on the cross said, I thirst, I thirst. And they reached up with a sponge of sour wine to give him something to drink. You have brought me to the dust of death. And predicting, of course, that Jesus would die. You go on in verse 16. They pierced my hands in my feet, as Jesus experienced at Calvary. I can count all my bones, as Jesus was beaten within an inch of his life before he even went to the cross. It's said that the cat of nine tails, with pieces of stone and bits of rock in the bedded end of the whip, were whipped across his back and shredded and pulled the flesh off of his back so that he was able to, was exposing even his bones and his insides at that horrible place. David says, they pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. Again, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. A direct connection to what happened at Jesus on the cross of Calvary. This is David, a man after God's own heart, writing his own expression of something that would happen 1,000 years from his time. But then look at verse 21 at the last part. David in his grief. David in his despair. He says, God, you have answered me. You have answered me. I want you to know, friend, that no matter where you are, and no matter how you align with the testimony of David, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? An answer does come. An answer does come. In God's plan, in God's economy, in God's timing, God shows up with the answer that is better than any human imagined answer that we could come up with. He shows up with the answer to the cries of his people. So what should we do? How do we respond to the suffering of David and the suffering of Jesus? Reggie and I were traveling this week and we were talking about this passage of Scripture. We had a great pastoral dialogue about it. And one of the things that Reggie told me was that in the nation of India, that is categorized by what's called the caste system, that there are the more important people and the less important people according to their custom and tradition. And predictably, the ones who are the higher caste, wealthier, more privileged, more opportunity, are the ones to be envied. And the lower you go, the worse it is. That's the view of the nation and the caste system and the view of the people. And people lord their caste over another of a lower caste or a lower ranking. But there is a group of people in India that are so low that they are not even in the caste system. They are called the Dalits. Is that right, Pastor? The Dalits. To me, it sounds like delete, like the delete button on your computer. They're called the Dalits. And they are the lowest of the low. And you could imagine the great suffering that they endure as a course of life. But as Reggie and I talked even more, even in India, the Dalits are recognized to be a people that suffer so much that they have an enviable position of beginning to understand the suffering of Jesus in a way that nobody else in the caste system and nobody else can understand. And in the spiritual view, they are a people to be envied. They are a people to be recognized because they, more than anybody, align themselves in a comprehensive way with the suffering of Jesus. Jesus said it this way in the New Testament. He said, in the kingdom of God, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. And so, dear friend, I want you to be encouraged by the Dalits today. If you find yourself to be in the category of the Dalit, you find yourself to be in a place of suffering, the suffering that you experience and I experience in life, even doesn't even touch the incomplete suffering of Jesus, but to the degree that it does, and ultimately is a way to align ourselves and understand more deeply the suffering of Jesus, the suffering of David for you and for me. So what should I do? What should we do when we suffer and feel separated from God? Well, the first thought is this. I should trust God even when my prayers are not answered. I should trust Him even when He does not seem to speak. When Jesus Himself taught about prayer in the New Testament, He told parables and these stories and He ultimately summarized it by this. He said in prayer, keep on asking, keep on seeking, keep on knocking, keep on bothering heaven, keep on bothering God. Even make yourself a bit of a nuisance until you hear from God. And it is our place to continue to expect that God will answer our prayers. To continue to expect that God will show up ultimately. To continue to expect that at one point God will show up and show off and prove Himself to be faithful to you and to me. Secondly, as we respond to Jesus Christ and as we respond to the Father who teaches us about suffering, I should see the greatness of my sin and the greater greatness of Christ's love. You see, our tendency is to do the opposite. Our tendency is to minimize our sin and appreciate the love of God. But the truth of it is, the greater our sin in our view, the greater the magnified love of Christ is toward us while we are in our sin. And so when we come to the place of realizing that there are times when we've caused our own separation from God, God has removed Himself because of our belligerent ways and our determination to sin anyway. That as we magnify our sin and the significance of it and the significance of empowering God to move away from us, the greater the sin, the greater the restoration. And it shows just how much Christ loves us. So we come before Him confessing. We come before Him clean. We come before Him to be right so that God can return to us through Jesus and forgive us of our sin and heal us of whatever has caused us to be separated. Thirdly, I should submit to Him knowing that He ordains suffering to come in my life. He doesn't necessarily cause it, but He knows that it happens. And He ordains it to come in my life. And to be able to say with Jesus, Father, whatever You have for me, empower me to go through it. Whatever You bring me through, give me the strength to go through it. And whatever You bring me through, I'll give the testimony of deliverance back to You. Whatever trial, whatever difficulty, whatever experience I go through, I'll give the testimony of deliverance back to You. My God, why hast Thou forsaken me? And David came to the place where he said, You answered me.